Binah. Chapter 7. Do not expect too much of the end of the world. Stanislav J. Lets, Aforizmi, Fraschki, Krakow, Vidovnitstvo Literatsky, 1977. Misli Nyuchezana. To enter a university a year or two after 1968 was like being admitted to the Académie de Saint-Cyr in 1793. You felt your birth date was wrong. Jacopo Belbo, who was almost 15 years older than I, later convinced me that every generation feels this way. You are always born under the wrong sign, and to live in this world properly you have to rewrite your own horoscope day by day. I believe that what we become depends on what our fathers teach us at odd moments when they aren't trying to teach us. We are formed by little scraps of wisdom. When I was 10, I asked my parents to subscribe to a weekly magazine that was publishing comic strip versions of the great classics of literature. My father, not because he was stingy, but because he was suspicious of comic strips, tried to beg off. "The purpose of this magazine," I pontificated, quoting the ad, "is to educate the reader in an entertaining way." "The purpose of your magazine," my father replied without looking up from his paper, "is the purpose of every magazine, to sell as many copies as it can." That day, I began to be incredulous. Or rather, I regretted having been credulous. I regretted having allowed myself to be borne away by a passion of the mind. Such is credulity. Not that the incredulous person doesn't believe in anything, it's just that he doesn't believe in everything, or he believes in one thing at a time. He believes a second thing only if it somehow follows from the first thing. He is nearsighted and methodical, avoiding wide horizons. If two things don't fit, but you believe both of them, thinking that somewhere hidden there must be a third thing that connects them, that's credulity. Incredulity doesn't kill curiosity, it encourages it. Though distrustful of logical chains of ideas, I love the polyphony of ideas. As long as you don't believe in them, the collision of two ideas, both false, can create a pleasing interval, a kind of diabolus in musica. I had no respect for some ideas people were willing to stake their lives on, but two or three ideas that I did not respect might still make a nice melody, or have a good beat, and if it was jazz, all the better. "You live on the surface," Leah told me years later. "You sometimes seem profound, but it's only because you piece a lot of surfaces together to create the impression of depth, solidity. That solidity would collapse if you tried to stand it up." "Are you saying I'm superficial?" "No," she answered. "What others call profundity is only a tesseract, a four-dimensional cube. You walk in one side and come out the other, and you're in their universe, which can't coexist with yours." "Leah, now that they have walked into the cube and invaded our world, I don't know if I'll ever see you again. And it was all my fault. I made them believe there was a depth that they, in their weakness, desired." What did I really think 15 years ago? A non-believer, I felt guilty in the midst of all those believers. And since it seemed to me that they were in the right, I decided to believe, as you might decide to take an aspirin. It can't hurt, and you might get better. So there I was in the midst of the revolution, or at least in the most stupendous imitation of it, seeking an honorable faith. It was honorable, for example, to take part in rallies and marches. I chanted, "Fascist scum, your time has come," with everybody else. I never threw paving stones or ball bearings out of fear that others might do unto me as I did unto them, but I experienced a kind of moral excitement escaping along narrow downtown streets when the police charged. I would come home with a sense of having performed a duty. In the meetings, I remained untouched by the disagreements that divided the various groups. I always had the feeling that if you substituted the right phrase for another phrase, you could move from group to group. I amused myself by finding the right phrases. I modulated. At the demonstrations, I would fall in behind one banner or another, drawn by a girl who had aroused my interest, so I came to the conclusion that for many of my companions, political activism was a sexual thing. But sex was a passion. I wanted only curiosity. True, in the course of my reading about the Templars and the various atrocities attributed to them, I had come across Carpocrates' assertion that to escape the tyranny of the angels, the masters of the cosmos, every possible ignominy should be perpetrated. That you should discharge all debts to the world and to your own body, for only by committing every act can the soul be freed of its passions and return to its original purity. When we were inventing the plan, I found that many addicts of the occult pursued that path in their search for enlightenment. According to his biographers, Aleister Crowley, who has been called the most perverted man of all time and who did everything that could be done with his worshippers, both men and women, chose only the ugliest partners of either sex. I have the nagging suspicion, however, that his lovemaking was incomplete. There must be a connection between the lust for power and impotentia coeundi. I liked Marx. I was sure that he and his Jenny had made love merrily. You can feel it in the easy pace of his prose and in his humor. On the other hand, I remember remarking one day in the corridors of the university that if you screwed Krupskaya all the time, you'd end up writing a lousy book like Materialism and Imperial Criticism. I was almost clubbed. A tall guy with a Tartar mustache said I was a fascist. I'll never forget him. He later shaved his head and now belongs to a commune where they weave baskets. I evoke the mood of those days only to reconstruct my state of mind when I began to visit Caramont Press and made friends with Jacopo Belbo. I was the type who looked at discussions of what is truth only with a view toward correcting the manuscript. If you were to quote, "I am that I am," for example, I thought that the fundamental problem was where to put the comma, inside the quotation marks or outside. That's why I wisely chose philology. The University of Milan was the place to be in those years. Everywhere else in the country, students were taking over classrooms and telling the professors they should teach only proletarian sciences. But at our university, except for a few incidents, a constitutional pact, or rather, a territorial compromise, held. The revolution occupied the grounds, the auditorium, and the main halls, while traditional culture, protected, withdrew to the inner corridors and upper floors, where it went on talking as if nothing had happened. The result was that I could spend the morning debating proletarian matters downstairs and the afternoon pursuing aristocratic knowledge upstairs. In these two parallel universes, I lived comfortably and felt no contradiction. I firmly believed that an egalitarian society was dawning, but I also thought that the trains, for example, in this better society ought to run better, and the militants around me were not learning how to shovel coal into the furnace, work the switches, or draw up timetables. Somebody had to be ready to operate the trains. I felt like a kind of Stalin, laughing to himself, somewhat remorsefully, and thinking, "Go ahead, you poor Bolsheviks. I'm going to study in this seminary in Tiflis, and we'll see which one of us gets to draft the 5-year plan." Perhaps because I was always surrounded by enthusiasm in the morning, in the afternoon I came to equate learning with distrust. I wanted to study something that confined itself to what could be documented, as opposed to what was merely a matter of opinion. For no particular reason, I signed up for a seminar on medieval history and chose, for my thesis subject, the Trial of the Templars. It was a story that fascinated me from the moment I first glanced at the documents. At that time, when we were struggling against those in power, I was wholeheartedly outraged by the trial in which the Templars, through evidence it would be generous to call circumstantial, were sentenced to the stake. Then I quickly learned that for centuries after their execution, countless lovers of the occult persisted in looking for them, seeking everywhere, without ever producing proof of their existence. This visionary excess offended my incredulity, and I resolved to waste no more time on these hunters of secrets. I would stick to primary sources. The Templars were monastic knights. Their order was recognized by the Church. If the Church dissolved that order, as in fact it had 7 centuries ago, then the Templars could no longer exist. Therefore, if they existed, they weren't Templars. I drew up a bibliography of more than 100 books, but in the end read only about 30 of them. It was through the Templars that I first got to know Jacopo Belbo at Pilades toward the end of 72, when I was at work on my thesis. Chapter 8. Having come from the light and from the gods, here I am in exile, separated from them. Fragment of Turfan, M7. In those days, Pilades Bar was a free port, a galactic tavern where alien invaders from Ofiuco could rub elbows peaceably with the soldiers of the Empire patrolling the Van Allen Belt. It was an old bar near one of the Navigli, the Milan canals, with a zinc counter and a billiard table. Local tram drivers and artisans would drop in first thing in the morning for a glass of white wine. In 68 and in the years that followed, Pilades became a kind of Rick's Café, where movement activists could play cards with a reporter from the boss's newspaper who had come in for a whiskey after putting the paper to bed, while the first trucks were already out distributing the establishment's lies to the newsstands. But at Pilates, the reporter also felt like an exploited proletarian, a producer of surplus value chained to an ideological assembly line, and the students forgave him. Between 11 at night and 2 in the morning, you might see a young publisher, an architect, a crime reporter trying to work his way up to the arts page, some Brera Academy painters, a few semi-successful writers, and students like me. A minimum of alcoholic stimulation was the rule, and old Pilade, while he still stocked his big bottles of white for the tram drivers and the most aristocratic customers, replaced root beer and cream soda with Pétillon wines with the right labels for the intellectuals and Johnny Walker for the revolutionaries. I could write the political history of those years based on how Red Label gradually gave way to 12-year-old Valentine and then to single malt. At the old billiard table, the painters and motormen still challenged each other to games, but with the arrival of the new clientele, Pilade also put in a pinball machine. I was never able to make the little balls last. At first I attributed that to absent-mindedness or a lack of manual dexterity. I learned the truth years later after watching Lorenza Pellegrini play. At the beginning I hadn't noticed her, but then she came into focus one evening when I followed the direction of Belbo's gaze. Belbo had a way of standing at the bar as if he were just passing through. He had been a regular there for at least 10 years. He often took part in conversations, at the counter or at a table, but almost always he did no more than drop some short remark that would instantly freeze all enthusiasm, no matter what subject was being discussed. He had another freezing technique, asking a question. Someone would be talking about an event, the whole group would be completely absorbed. Then Belbo, turning his pale, slightly absent eyes on the speaker, with his glass at hip level, as though he had long forgotten he was drinking, would ask, "Is that a fact?" or "Really?" At which point everyone, including the narrator, would suddenly begin to doubt the story. Maybe it was the way Belbo's Piedmont drawl made his statements interrogative and his interrogatives taunting. And he had yet another Piedmont trick, looking into his interlocutor's eyes, but as if he were avoiding them. His gaze didn't exactly shirk dialogue, but he would suddenly seem to concentrate on some distant convergence of parallel lines no one had paid attention to. He made you feel that you'd been staring all this time at the one place that was unimportant. It wasn't just his gaze. Belbo could dismiss you with the smallest gesture, a brief interjection. Suppose you were trying hard to show that it was Kant who really completed the Copernican Revolution in modern philosophy. Suppose you were staking your whole future on that thesis. Belbo, sitting opposite you with his eyes half closed, would suddenly look down at his hands or at his knee with an Etruscan smile. Or he would sit back with his mouth open, eyes on the ceiling, and mumble, "Yes, Kant." Or he would commit himself more explicitly in an assault on the whole system of transcendental idealism. "You really think Kant meant all that stuff?" Then he would look at you with solicitude, as if you, and not he, had disturbed the spell, and he would then encourage you. "Go ahead, go ahead. I mean, there must be something to it. The man had a mind, after all." But sometimes Belbo, when he became really angry, lost his composure. Since loss of composure was the one thing he could not tolerate in others, his own was wholly internal and regional. He would purse his lips, raise his eyes, then look down, tilt his head to the left, and say in a soft voice, "Magavte lanata." For anyone who didn't know that Piedmontese expression, he would occasionally explain, "Magavte lanata, take out the cork." You say it to one who is full of himself, the idea being that what causes him to swell and strut is the pressure of a cork stuck in his behind. Remove it, and psh, he returns to the human condition. Belbo's remarks had a way of making you see the vanity of things, and they delighted me. But I drew the wrong conclusion from them, considering them an expression of supreme contempt for the banality of other people's truth. Now, having breached the secret of Abulafia, and with it Belbo's soul, I see that what I thought disenchantment and a philosophy of life was a form of melancholy. His intellectual disrespect concealed a desperate thirst for the absolute. This was not immediately obvious, because Belbo had many moods, irresponsibility, hesitation, indifference. And there were also moments when he relaxed and enjoyed conversation, asserting absolutely contradictory ideas with lighthearted disbelief. Then he and Diotalevi would create handbooks for impossibilities, or invent upside-down worlds or bibliographical monstrosities. When you saw him so enthusiastically talkative, reconstructing his Rabelaisian Sorbonne, there was no way of knowing how much he suffered at his exile from the Faculty of Theology, the real one. I had deliberately thrown that address away. He had mislaid it and could never resign himself to the loss. In Abulafia's files, I found many passages of a pseudo-diary that Belbo had entrusted to the password, confident that he was not betraying his often repeated vow to remain a mere spectator of the world. Some entries carried old dates. Obviously, he had put these on the computer out of nostalgia, or because he planned to recycle them eventually. Others were more recent, after the advent of Abu. His writing was a mechanical game, a solitary pondering on his own errors. But it was not, he thought, creation, for creation had to be inspired by love of someone who is not ourselves. But Belbo, without realizing it, had crossed that Rubicon. He was creating, unfortunately. His enthusiasm for the plan came from his ambition to write a book. No matter if the book were made entirely of errors, intentional deadly errors, as long as you remain in your private vacuum, you can pretend you are in harmony with the One. But the moment you pick up the clay, electronic or otherwise, you become a demiurge, and he who embarks on the creation of worlds is already tainted with corruption and evil. File name, A Bevy of Fair Women. It's like this. Toutes les femmes que j'ai rencontrées se dressent aux horizons, avec les gestes piteux et les regards tristes des sémaphores sous la pluie. Aim high, Belbo. First love, the most blessed virgin. Mama singing as she holds me on her lap, as if rocking me, though I'm past the age for lullabies. But I asked her to sing because I love her voice and the lavender scent of her bosom. O Queen of Heaven, fair and pure, hail, O daughter, Queen demure, hail, Mother of our Savior. Naturally, the first woman in my life was not mine. By definition, she was not anyone's. I fell immediately in love with the only person capable of doing everything without me. Then, Marilena. Mary Lena. Mary Lena. Describe the lyric twilight, her golden hair, big blue bow, me standing in front of the bench with my nose upward, she tightrope walking on the top rail of the back, swaying, arms outstretched for balance, delicious extra systoles, skirt flapping around her pink thighs, high above me, unattainable. Sketch, that same evening as Mama sprinkles talcum powder on my sister's pink skin. I ask when her wee-wee will finally grow out. Mama's answer is that little girls don't grow wee-wees, they stay like that. Suddenly I see Mary Lena again, the white of her underpants visible beneath a fluttering blue skirt, and I realize that she is blonde and haughty and inaccessible because she is different. No possible relationship. She belongs to another race. My third woman, swiftly lost in the abyss, where she has plunged. She has died in her sleep, virginal Ophelia amid flowers on her bier. The priest is reciting the prayer for the dead, when suddenly she sits up on the catafalque, pale, frowning, vindictive, pointing her finger and her voice cavernous. Don't pray for me, Father. Before I fell asleep last night, I had an impure thought. The only one in my life. And now I am damned. Find the book of my first communion. Does it have this illustration, or did I make the whole thing up? She must have died while thinking of me. I was the impure thought, desiring the untouchable Mary Lena, she of a different species and fate. I am guilty of her damnation. I am guilty of the damnation of all women who are damned. It is right that I should not have had these three women, my punishment for wanting them. I lose the first because she's in paradise, the second because she's in purgatory envying the penis that will never be hers, and the third because she's in hell. Theologically symmetrical, but this has already been written. On the other hand, there's the story of Cecilia, and Cecilia is here on earth. I used to think about her before falling asleep. I would be climbing the hill on my way to the farm for milk, and when the partisans started shooting at the roadblock from the hill opposite, I pictured myself rushing to her rescue, saving her from the horde of fascist brigands who chased her, brandishing their weapons. Blonder than Mary Lena, more disturbing than the maiden in the sarcophagus, more pure and demure than the virgin. Cecilia, alive and accessible. I could have talked to her so easily, for I was sure she could love one of my species. And in fact she did. His name was Papi. He had wispy blonde hair and a tiny skull, was a year older than I, and had a saxophone. I didn't even have a trumpet. I never saw the two of them together, but all the kids at Sunday school laughed, poked one another in the ribs, and whispered, giggling, that the pair made love. They were probably lying, little peasants, horny as goats, but they were probably right that she, Marilena Cecilia, bride and queen, was accessible, so accessible that someone had already gained access to her. In any case, the fourth case, I was out in the cold. Could a story like this be made into a novel? Perhaps I should write instead about the women I avoid because I can have them. Or could have had them. Same story. If you can't even decide what the story is, better stick to editing books on philosophy. Chapter 9. In his right hand he held a golden trumpet. Johann Valentin André, Die chemische Hochzeit des Christian Rosenkreuz, Strasbourg, Setzner, 1616, 1. In this file I find the mention of a trumpet. The day before yesterday, in the periscope, I wasn't aware of its importance. The file had only one reference to it, and that marginal. During the long afternoons at the Garamond office, Belbo, tormented by a manuscript, would occasionally look up and try to distract me, too, as I sat at the desk across from his, sorting through old engravings of the World Fair. Then he would drift into reminiscence, prompt to ring down the curtain if he suspected I was taking him too seriously. He would recall scenes from his past, but only to illustrate a point, to castigate some vanity. "I wonder where all this is heading," he remarked one day. "You mean the twilight of Western civilization?" "Twilight? Let the sun handle twilight. No, I was talking about our writers. This is my third manuscript this week. One on Byzantine law, one on the Finis Austrii, and one on the poems of the Earl of Rochester. Three very different subjects, wouldn't you say?" "I would." "Yet in all these manuscripts, at one point or another, desire appears, and the object of desire. It must be a trend. With the Earl of Rochester, I can understand it, but Byzantine law?" "Just reject them." "I can't. All three books have been funded by the National Research Council." "Actually, they're not that bad. Maybe I'll just call the three authors and ask them to delete those parts. The desire stuff doesn't make them look good either." "What can the object of desire possibly be in Byzantine law?" "Oh, you can slip it in. If there ever was an object of desire in Byzantine law, of course, it wasn't what this guy says it was. It never is."
"Never is what?"
"What you think it is. Once, I was 5 or 6, I dreamed I had a trumpet, a gold trumpet. It was one of those dreams where you can feel honey flowing in your veins. You know what I mean? A kind of prepubescent wet dream. I don't think I've ever been as happy as I was in that dream. When I woke up, I realized there was no trumpet, and I started crying. I cried all day. This was before the war, but must have been 38, a time of poverty. If I had a son today and saw him in such despair, I'd say, 'All right, I'll buy you a trumpet.' It was only a toy, after all. It couldn't have cost a fortune. But my parents never even considered such a thing. Spending money was a serious business in those days, and they were serious, too, about teaching a child he couldn't have everything he wanted. 'I can't stand cabbage soup,' I'd tell them, and it was true, for God's sake. Cabbage made me sick. But they never said, 'Skip the soup today, then, and just eat your meat.' We may have been poor, but we still had a first course, a main course, and fruit. No, it was always, 'Eat what's on the table.' Sometimes, as a compromise, my grandmother would pick the cabbage out of my bowl, stringy piece by stringy piece. Then I'd have to eat the expurgated soup, which was more disgusting than before. And even this was a concession my father disapproved of." "But what about the trumpet?" He looked at me, hesitant. "Why are you so interested in the trumpet?" "I'm not. You were the one who brought it up, to show how the object of desire is never what others think."
"The trumpet."
"My uncle and aunt from—" name omitted— "arrived that evening. They had no children, and I was their favorite nephew. Well, When they saw me bawling over my dream trumpet, they said they would fix everything. Tomorrow we would go to the department store, where there was a whole counter of toys, wonder of wonders, and I'd have the trumpet I wanted. I didn't sleep all night, and I couldn't sit still all the next morning. In the afternoon we went to the store, and they had at least three kinds of trumpets there. Little tin things, probably, but to me they were magnificent brass worthy of the Philharmonic. There was an army bugle, a slide trombone, and a trumpet of gold with a real trumpet mouthpiece but the keys of a saxophone. I couldn't decide, and maybe I took too long. Wanting them all, I must have given the impression that I didn't want any of them. Meanwhile, I believe my uncle and aunt looked at the price tags. My uncle and aunt weren't stingy. On the other hand, a Bakelite clarinet with silver keys was much cheaper. "Wouldn't you like this better?" they asked. I tried it, produced a reasonable honk, and told myself that it was beautiful, but actually I was rationalizing. I knew they wanted me to take the clarinet because the trumpet cost a fortune. I couldn't demand such a sacrifice from my relatives, having been taught that if a person offers you something you like, you must say, "No, thank you." And not just once, not "no, thank you" with your hand out, but "no, thank you" until the giver insists, until he says, "Please, take it." A well-bred child doesn't accept until that point. So I said maybe I didn't care about the trumpet, maybe the clarinet was all right if that's what they wanted. And I looked up at them, hoping they would insist. They didn't, God bless them. They were delighted to buy me the clarinet, since, they said, that was what I wanted. It was too late to backtrack. I got the clarinet. Belbo looked at me out of the corner of his eyes. "You want to know if I dreamed about the trumpet again?" "I want to know," I said, "what the object of desire was." "Ah," he said, turning back to his manuscript. "You see, you're obsessed by the object of desire, too. But it's not all that simple. Suppose I had taken the trumpet. Would I have been truly happy then? What do you think, Kasaubin?" "I think you would have dreamed about the clarinet." "I got the clarinet," he concluded sharply, "but I never played it." "Never played it, or never dreamed it?" "Played it," he said, underlining his words, and for some reason I felt like a fool. Chapter 10. And finally, nothing is cabalistically inferred from vinum, save vis num errorum, upon which numbers this magia depends. Cesare della Riviera, Il mondo magico degli eroi. Mantua, Ozana, 1603, pages 65-66. But I was talking about my first encounter with Belbo. We knew each other by sight, had exchanged a few words at Pilades, but I didn't know much about him, only that he worked at Garamond Press, a small but serious publisher. I had come across a few Garamond books at the university. "And what do you do?" he asked me one evening, as we were both leaning against the far end of the zinc bar, pressed close together by a festive crowd. He used the formal pronoun. In those days we all called one another by the familiar "tu," even students and professors, even the clientele at Pilades. "Tu, buy me a drink," a student wearing a parka would say to the managing editor of an important newspaper. It was like Moscow in the days of young Shklovsky. We were all Mayakovskis, not one Zhivago among us. Belbo could not avoid the required "tu," but he used it with pointed scorn, suggesting that although he was responding to vulgarity with vulgarity, there was still an abyss between acting intimate and being intimate. I heard him say "too" with real affection only a few times, only to a few people, Diotalevi, one or two women. He used the formal pronoun with people he respected but hadn't known long. He addressed me formally the whole time we worked together, and I valued that. "And what do you do?" he asked, with what I now know as friendliness. "In real life or in this theater?" I said, nodding at our surroundings. "In real life." "I study." "You mean you go to the university or you study?" "You may not believe this, but the two need not be mutually exclusive. I'm finishing a thesis on the Templars." "What an awful subject," he said. "I thought that was for lunatics." "No, I'm studying the real stuff, the documents of the trial. What do you know about the Templars, anyway?" "I work for a publishing company. We deal with both lunatics and non-lunatics. After a while, an editor can pick out the lunatics right away. If somebody brings up the Templars, he's almost always a lunatic." "Don't I know? Their name is Legion. But not all lunatics talk about the Templars. How do you identify the others?" "I'll explain. By the way, what's your name?"
Kasaubin.
Kasaubin? Wasn't he a character in Middlemarch?
I don't know. There was also a Renaissance philologist by that name, but we're not related.
The next round's on me. Two more, Pilate.
All right, then. There are four kinds of people in this world. Cretans, fools, morons, and lunatics.
And that covers everybody?
Oh, yes, including us. Or at least me. If you take a good look, everybody fits into one of these categories. Each of us is sometimes a cretin, a fool, a moron, or a lunatic. A normal person is just a reasonable mix of these components, these four ideal types.
Idealtypen.
Very good. You know German?
Enough for bibliographies.
When I was in school, if you knew German, you never graduated. You just spent your life knowing German. Nowadays, I think that happens with Chinese.
My German's poor, so I'll graduate.
But let's get back to your typology. What about geniuses? Einstein, for example.
A genius uses one component in a dazzling way, fueling it with the others.
He took a sip of his drink.
Hi there, beautiful, he said. Made that suicide attempt yet?
No, a girl answered as she walked by. I'm in a collective now.
Good for you, Belbo said.
He turned back to me. Of course, there's no reason one can't have collective suicides, too.
Getting back to the lunatics.
Oh, look, don't take me too literally. I'm not trying to put the universe in order. I'm just saying what a lunatic is from the point of view of a publishing house. Mine is an ad hoc definition.
All right, my round.
All right, less ice, Pilate. Otherwise it gets into the bloodstream too fast.
Now then, cretins.
Cretins don't even talk. They sort of slobber and stumble. You know, the guy who presses the ice cream cone against his forehead or enters a revolving door the wrong way.
That's not possible.
It is for a cretin. Cretins are of no interest to us. They never come to publishers' offices, so let's forget about them.
Let's?
Being a fool is more complicated. It's a form of social behavior. A fool is one who always talks outside his class.
What do you mean?
Like this.
He pointed at the counter near his glass.
He wants to talk about what's in the glass, but somehow or other he misses. He's the guy who puts his foot in his mouth. For example, he says, "How's your lovely wife?" to someone whose wife has just left him.
Yes, I know a few of those.
Fools are in great demand, especially on social occasions. They embarrass everyone but provide material for conversation. In their positive form, they become diplomats. Talking outside the glass when someone else blunders helps to change the subject. But fools don't interest us either. They're never creative, their talent is all second-hand, so they don't submit manuscripts to publishers. Fools don't claim that cats bark, but they talk about cats when everyone else is talking about dogs. They offend all the rules of conversation, and when they really offend, they're magnificent. It's a dying breed, the embodiment of all the bourgeois virtues. What they really need is a Verdurin salon, or even a Chez Guermont.
Do you students still read such things?
I do.
Well, a fool is a Joachim Murat, reviewing his officers. He sees one from Martinique covered with medals.
Vous êtes nègre? Murat asks.
Oui, mon général, the man answers.
And Murat says, bravo, bravo, continuez, and so on. You follow me?
Forgive me, but tonight I'm celebrating a historic decision in my life. I've stopped drinking.
Another round?
Don't answer, you'll make me feel guilty. Pilate!
What about the morons?
Ah, morons never do the wrong thing. They get their reasoning wrong.
Like the fellow who says all dogs are pets and all dogs bark, and cats are pets too, and therefore cats bark. Or that all Athenians are mortal and all the citizens of Piraeus are mortal, so all the citizens of Piraeus are Athenians.
Which they are.
Yes, but only accidentally. Morons will occasionally say something that's right, but they say it for the wrong reason.
You mean it's okay to say something that's wrong as long as the reason is right?
Of course. Why else go to the trouble of being a rational animal?
All great apes evolved from lower life forms. Man evolved from lower life forms. Therefore, man is a great ape.
Not bad. In such statements, you suspect that something's wrong, but it takes work to show what and why. Morons are tricky. You can spot the fool right away, not to mention the cretin. But the moron reasons almost the way you do. The gap is infinitesimal. A moron is a master of paralogism. For an editor, it's bad news. It can take him an eternity to identify a moron. Plenty of morons' books are published because they're convincing at first glance. An editor is not required to weed out the morons. If the Academy of Sciences doesn't do it, why should he? Philosophers don't either. St. Anselm's ontological argument is moronic, for example. God must exist because I can conceive him as being perfect in all ways, including existence. The saint confuses existence in thought with existence in reality. True, but Gonilon's refutation is moronic, too. I can think of an island in the sea even if the island doesn't exist. He confuses thinking of the possible with thinking of the necessary. A duel between morons. Exactly, and God loves every minute of it. He chose to be unthinkable only to prove that Anselm and Gonilon were morons. What a sublime purpose for creation. Or rather, for that act by which God willed himself to be, to unmask cosmic moronism. We're surrounded by morons. Everyone's a moron, save me and thee, or rather, I wouldn't want to offend, save thee. Somehow I feel that Gödel's theorem has something to do with all this. I wouldn't know, I'm a Cretan. Pilate! My round. We'll split it. Epimenides the Cretan says all Cretans are liars. It must be true because he's a Cretan himself and knows his countrymen well. That's moronic thinking. St. Paul, Epistle to Titus. On the other hand, those who call Epimenides a liar have to think all Cretans aren't, but Cretans don't trust Cretans, therefore no Cretan calls Epimenides a liar. Isn't that moronic thinking? You decide. I told you, they're hard to identify. Morons can even win the Nobel Prize. Hold on. Of those who don't believe God created the world in 7 days, some are not fundamentalists, but of those who do believe God created the world in 7 days, some are. Therefore, of those who don't believe God created the world in 7 days, some are fundamentalists. How's that? My God, to use the mot juste, I wouldn't know. A moronism or not? It is, definitely, even if it were true. Violates one of the laws of syllogisms. Universal conclusions cannot be drawn from two particulars. And what if you were a moron? I'd be an excellent, venerable company. You're right. And perhaps, in a logical system different from ours, our moronism is wisdom. The whole history of logic consists of attempts to define an acceptable notion of moronism. A task too immense. Every great thinker is someone else's moron. Thought is the coherent expression of moronism. But what is moronism to one is incoherence to another. Profound. It's 2 o'clock, Pilate's about to close, and we still haven't got to the lunatics. I'm getting there. A lunatic is easily recognized. He is a moron who doesn't know the ropes. The moron proves his thesis. He has a logic, however twisted it may be. The lunatic, on the other hand, doesn't concern himself at all with logic. He works by short circuits. For him, everything proves everything else. The lunatic is all idée fixe, and whatever he comes across confirms his lunacy. You can tell him by the liberties he takes with common sense, by his flashes of inspiration, and by the fact that sooner or later he brings up the Templars. Invariably? There are lunatics who don't bring up the Templars, but those who do are the most insidious. At first they seem normal, then all of a sudden... He was about to order another whiskey, but changed his mind and asked for the check. Speaking of the Templars, the other day some character left me a manuscript on the subject, a lunatic, but with a human face. The book starts reasonably enough. Would you like to see it? I'd be glad to. Maybe there's something I can use. I doubt that very much. But drop in if you have a spare half hour. Number 1, Via Sincero Renato. The visit will be of more benefit to me than to you. You can tell me whether the book has any merit. What makes you trust me? Who says I trust you? But if you come, I'll trust you. I trust curiosity. A student rushed in, face twisted in anger. Comrades, there are fascists along the canal with chains. Let's get them, said the fellow with the Tartar mustache who had threatened me over Krupskaya. Come on, comrades, and they all left. What do you want to do? I asked, feeling guilty. Should we go along? No, Belbo said. Pilate sets these things up to clear the place out. For my first night on the wagon, I feel pretty high. Must be the cold turkey effect. Everything I've said to you so far is false. Good night, Kasavin. Chapter 11. His sterility was infinite. It was part of the ecstasy.
E. M. Cioran, Le Mauvais Demiurge, Paris, Gallimard, 1969. Pensée étranglée.
The conversation at Pilates had shown me the public Belbo, but a keen observer would have been able to sense the melancholy behind the sarcasm. Not that Belbo's sarcasm was the mask. The mask, perhaps, was the private confessing he did, or perhaps his melancholy itself was the mask, a contrivance to hide a deeper melancholy. There is a document in which he tried to fictionalize what he told me about his job when I went to Garamond the next day. It contains all his precision and passion, the disappointment of an editor who could write only through others while yearning for creativity of his own. It also has the moral severity that led him to punish himself for desiring something to which he did not feel entitled. Though he painted his desire in pathetic and garish hues, I never knew a man who could pity himself with such contempt. File name, Seven Seas Jim. Tomorrow, see young Chinti. 1. Good monograph, scholarly, perhaps a bit too scholarly. 2. In the conclusion, the comparison between Catullus, the Poeti Novi, and today's avant-garde is the best part. 3. Why not make this the introduction? 4. Convince him. He'll say that such flights of fancy don't belong in a philological series. He's afraid of alienating his professor, who is supposed to write the authoritative preface. A brilliant idea in the last two pages might go unnoticed, but at the beginning it would be too conspicuous. It would irritate the academic powers that be. 5. If, however, it is put into italics in a conversational form separate from the actual scholarship, then the hypothesis remains only a hypothesis and doesn't undermine the seriousness of the work, and readers will be captivated at once. They'll approach the book in a totally different way. Am I urging him to an act of freedom, or am I using him to write my own book? Transforming books with a word here, a word there. Demiurge for the work of others, tapping at the hardened clay at the statue someone else has already carved, instead of taking soft clay and molding my own. Give Moses the right tap with a hammer and he'll talk. See William S. I've looked at your work. Not bad. It has tension, imagination. Is this the first piece you've written? No, I wrote another tragedy. It's the story of two lovers in Verona who... Oh, let's talk about this piece first, Mr. S. I was wondering why you said it in France. May I suggest Denmark? It wouldn't require much work if you just change two or three names and turn the Chateau of Chalon-sur-Marne into, say, the Castle of Elsinore. In a Nordic Protestant atmosphere, in the shadow of Kierkegaard, so to speak, all these existential overtones...
Perhaps you're right.
I think I am. The work might need a little touching up stylistically. Nothing drastic. The barber snips before he holds up the mirror for you, so to speak. The father's ghost, for example. Why at the end? I put him at the beginning. That way the father's warning helps motivate the young prince's behavior, and it establishes the conflict with the mother.
Good idea. I'd only have to move one scene.
Exactly. Now style. This passage here, where the prince turns to the audience and begins his monologue on action and inaction. It's a nice speech, but he doesn't sound, well, troubled enough. To act or not to act, this is my problem. I would say not my problem, but the question. That is the question. You see what I mean? It's not so much his individual problem as it is the whole question of existence, the question whether to be or not to be. If you fill the world with children who do not bear your name, no one will know they are yours.
If you fill the world with children who do not bear your name, no one will know they are yours. Like being God in plain clothes. You are God. You wander through the city. You hear people talking about you. God this, God that. What a wonderful universe this is. And how elegant the law of gravity. And you smile to yourself behind your fake beard. No, better to go without a beard, because in a beard God is immediately recognizable. You soliloquize. God is always soliloquizing. Here I am, the one, and they don't know it. If a pedestrian bumps into you in the street, or even insults you, you humbly apologize and move on, even though you're God and with a snap of your fingers can turn the world to ashes. But infinitely powerful as you are, you can afford to be long-suffering. A novel about God incognito. No. If I thought of it, somebody else must have already done it. You're an author, not yet aware of your powers. The woman you loved has betrayed you. Life for you no longer has meaning. So one day, to forget, you take a trip on the Titanic under shipwrecked in the South Seas. You are picked up, the sole survivor, by a pirogue full of natives, and spend long years, forgotten by the outside world, on this island inhabited only by Papuans. Girls serenade you with languorous songs, their swaying breasts barely covered by necklaces of pua blossoms. They call you Jim. They call all white men Jim. And one night an amber-skinned girl slips into your hut and says, "I yours, I with you." How nice, to lie there in the evening on the veranda and look up at the Southern Cross while she fans your brow. You live by the cycle of dawn and sunset, and know nothing else. One day a motorboat arrives with some Dutchmen aboard. You learn that 10 years have passed. You could go away with these Dutchmen, but you refuse. You start a business trading coconuts. You supervise the hemp harvest. The natives work for you. You sail from island to island, and everyone calls you Seven Seas Jim. A Portuguese adventurer, ruined by drink, comes to work with you and redeems himself. By now you're the talk of the Sunda. You advise the Maharaja of Brunei and his campaign against the Dayaks of the river. You find an old cannon from the days of Tippo Saib and get it back in working order. You train a squad of devoted Malayans whose teeth are blackened with beetle. In a skirmish near the coral reef, old Sampan, his teeth blackened with beetle, shields you with his own body. "I gladly die for you, Seven Seas Jim." Good old Sampan. Farewell, my friend. Now you're famous in the whole archipelago, from Sumatra to Port-au-Prince. You trade with the English, too. At the harbormaster's office in Darwin, you're registered as Kurtz, and now you're Kurtz to everyone. Only the natives still call you Seven Seas Jim. One evening, as the girl caresses you on the veranda, and the Southern Cross shines brighter than ever overhead, ah, so different from the Great Bear, you realize you want to go back, just for a little while, to see what, if anything, is left of you there. You take a boat to Manila, from there a prop plane to Bali, then Samoa, the Admiralty Islands, Singapore, Tenerife, Timbuktu, Aleppo, Samarkand, Basra, Malta, and your home. 18 years have passed. Life has left its mark on you. Your face is tanned by the trade winds. You're older, perhaps also handsomer. Arriving, you discover that all the bookshops are displaying your books in new critical editions, and your name has been carved into the pediment of your old school, where you learned to read and write. You are the great vanished poet, the conscience of a generation. Romantic maidens kill themselves at your empty grave. And then I encounter you, my love, with those wrinkles around your eyes, your face still beautiful, though worn by memory and tender remorse. I almost pass you on the sidewalk. I'm only a few feet away, and you look at me as you look at all people, as though seeking another beyond their shadow. I could speak, erase the years, but to what end? Am I not, even now, fulfilled? I am like God, as solitary as he, as vain, and as despairing, unable to be one of my creatures. They dwell in my light, while I dwell in unbearable darkness, the source of that light. Go in peace, then, William S. Famous, you pass and do not recognize me. I murmur to myself, to be or not to be. And I say to myself, good for you, Belbo, good work. Go, old William S., and reap your meed of glory. You alone created. I merely made a few changes. We midwives, who assist at the births of what others conceive, should be refused burial in consecrated ground, like actors, except that actors play with the world as it is, while we play with the plurality of make-believes, with the endless possibilities of existence in an infinite universe. How can life be so bountiful, providing such sublime rewards for mediocrity?